Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update providing up-to-the-minute information on interest rates, loan programs, and hot industry news relating to the mortgage industry. Brought to you by Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. To participate in today's program, our guest call-in line is 646-716-4972. And now, here is your host of Lickin' on Lending, David Lickin.
So good to have you with us, everybody. Appreciate you tuning in and just being a part of the broadcast. Again, for those of you that are downloading this broadcast and listening to it on a downloaded basis, it is Monday, May 11th, and we're privileged to have as our special guest in the Hot Topic segment, David Stevens, President and Chairman of the MBA. Very pleased and excited to have him here. We're going to be talking about issues that he's saying. I actually wrote David and it said, Dave, what are the top-of-mind issues? What are the things that you are looking at on that's really caught your attention right now? And he shot back some good ones, and we're talking about the one that caught my attention was stopping excessive enforcement, needed changes to Dodd-Frank rules, issues related to SAFE Act, transitional licensing, and marketing agreements. Now, there's some more that we hopefully have time to cover, but those we're going to get through for sure, so you're going to want to stay tuned all the way through to the end of the broadcast. So many of you, and it's always fun when you got someone like David on the broadcast. We have so many people dialing in. I see so many of you dialing in to the switchboard right now. It is just lighting up. So good to have you all joining us, whether it's dialing in from your cell phones, from your offices. We've got one office in California that literally stops and uses this as their they said, Dave, we outsource our meetings and our market updates to you. We just put you on the overhead system. We just stop and listen in because you got such great content. So many of you that write us and tell us about our content, thank you so much. Where again, this is for you. It's our give back. 42, 43 years in this mortgage industry, and it's our give back. It's been a great industry for me, and I'm very pleased to be giving this back, and this is our way to do it. Again, this broadcast is created by mortgage professionals for mortgage professionals, and we're the proud recipient of the Progress in Lending Innovation Award. I want to say a big thank you to our sponsors, United Guaranty, who just happens to be the number one leader in the MI industry, in our industry, for four consecutive years. They recently published their quarterly U.S. housing update report. It's a comprehensive analysis of key housing indicators and selected economic statistics related to mortgage lending. It's an 18-page document full of charts and the state of the economy, digs deep into housing issues, and a lot of times it's a really comprehensive, great report, and really causes you to be able to look at many aspects of it. Now, the MBA has some outstanding material, and if you did not listen to the broadcast when we had Dr. Lynn Fisher on, that was back in April 20th. You want to go back and listen to that. She sat in for Mike Frattantoni, did a great job. But you know what? You're looking at so much data, and I'm always looking at all the ways it's presented. So I can't wait to get this report downloaded and read it. We can't get enough perspective on it, and there's an old proverb that says, in a multitude of war, and it seems like we're at times, get a multitude of counselors. So I think it's good to get multiple perspectives on this. So I'm really plotting them, United Guaranty, on this latest report, 18-page document. Go download it. Check it out. You can get it at their website at www.ugcorp.com and clicking on the Announcements tab for the housing report. Free. It's downloadable for you. Again, mortgage insurance underwritten by United Guaranty Residential Insurance Company. Also, a special thank you goes out to Virtual Electronic Marketing Company, or Assistant, also known as Velma, Velma.com. Love these guys. They do a great job of getting the notices out. In this case, they've put out several notices to draw in as many people because we really want to hear from strong leadership, and that's what we're going to be talking to today in the Hot Topic statement. Again, David Stevens will be joining us a little bit later. Normally, we would be going to Joe Farr at this point, but Joe is out of the office, and he is not there, so I'm giving his update for him, everybody. So good to have you with us. Before we do that, I want to alert everybody. We cover the upcoming MBA conferences each and every week, and the next one that I really want everybody to encourage you to be there, I'm encouraging all my clients to be there, and that is the upcoming National MBA National Secondary Marketing Conference and Expo. It's always in New York City, and it's almost always at the New York Marriott Marquis. Great venue, great location, and It's May 17th, again, through the 20th. If you're not registered, do so now. It's really an important topic because we look at what's going on in the secondary markets and look at what liquidity there is. There's been talk about liquidity issues in CNBC about the bond market and concerns about the liquidity issues as if interest rates start rising. So there's going to be a lot of great perspective. Mike Frattantoni will be there. By the way, our condolences to Mike. He just lost his dad, and that's the reason he had to miss the broadcast. So it was very sad. Sorry. So keep him in your thoughts and prayers. Let's take a look at what happened in the market, what's going on today. When Joe wrote this, it was down 7/32. It continues to plunge. We're down beyond. We're right now looking at about 13/14/32 down on the Fannie Mae 30-year, 3%. So market is given or taking away all the gains that we had on Friday. Again, we've been having 2 weeks of pretty consistent rate rises. The general feeling in the market is that interest rates are at the bottom. It has nothing to do but to go up. The question is when. But everyone gets myopically focused. They're going up. And, you know, look at that. They're still below 4%. These are still great rates. I don't know if you guys know this, but I do the Today's Mortgage Minute. It's for consumers. It's 120 radio, television, newspaper websites. And I do a video every day, 7 days a week, and it's just amazing. We have about 7.5 million to 16 million views each month of that update. So we're staying on top of these things, and it's interesting what consumers are feeling. When they see it inching up, they just start saying, okay, I guess it's over, but we really need to get out and be talking to consumers. I'm touching somewhere between 7.5 million and 16 million consumers every single month. And I got a real good gauge of what they're feeling. So you need to be showing leadership in your markets and talking about that these rates are still low. They need to be going. Last week, the trend for rising interest dominated most of the first half of the week. Rates rebounded on Thursday and Friday just a little bit, ending a net change. Again, we're feeling the upward pressure. That's mostly present. Janet Yellen's comments were very interesting. Joe highlights those in his comments, and specifically about how the stock market is overvalued and rates being too low. So when are they going to rate change? You know, the FOMC meeting minutes from the week before indicated there's clearly some differing opinions, quite an interesting polarization within the Feds on when to. Some feel that we need to start raising interest rates immediately. Some still feel that it could be 2016. So it's real interesting what's going on. So Janet Yellen being the leader there really gives us insights over the direction of the Federal Reserve. So, again, all this information is on MBS Quoteline's website, www.mbsquoteline.com. Let's take a look. The new job numbers were at better than what it was expected, and so that was the ADP payroll change. Well, actually, the ADP payroll change number was slightly worse. The new job creation was slightly better, and the unemployment rate fell to 5.4%. We saw market going, well, maybe rates aren't going to go up anytime too soon on that news, or, you know, we're not sure exactly how it is because there's no economic data coming out today. But tomorrow we have the JOLTS report. The retail sales is on Wednesday. And JOLTS, of course, stands for the Job Opening and Labor Turnover Survey. That'll give us it's a more comprehensive report. It's one that Janet Yellen uses, and we'll be paying close attention to that. Also, later in the week on Thursday, we have the PPI, which is the Producer Price Index, as well as the unemployment claims. We'll see if there's any adjustments to that number. Industrial Productivity in Empire State on Friday. Lots. We got Treasury auctions Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, as well as the 10-year auction on Wednesday. So lots of lots of indications how money is flowing this week. So Joe sends his greetings. He wishes he could be here with you. He really wanted to be in and participating in this discussion with David Stevens, but unfortunately, he had to be out of the office. So we wish him the very best and look forward to having him back next week. Folks, we're going to be right back after this brief break.
Looking for that competitive edge? MBS Quoteline delivers live market coverage for originators. Get up-to-the-minute mortgage market news and analysis as events occur.
Get MBS prices as trades happen.
Straight to your computer, email, cell phone, or PDA. Know in advance when your investors will reprice. Make better lock-float decisions and increase your income. Be the expert your clients expect and know what's moving interest rates right now, tomorrow, and beyond. MBS Quoteline, delivering live market coverage for originators. Learn more about MBS Quoteline today at MBSQuoteLine.com.
MBSQuoteLine.com.
646-716-4972. The Lickin' on Lending Show is back. Here is your host, David Lickin.
Good to have you with us. We've got Paul Malo joining us by phone. Paul, it's good to have you with us. I'm looking over at your website again. Great information. Again, folks, if you're not downloading www.imfnews.com, missing what's going on, give us an update there, Paul. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, David. Well, probably no surprise, non-banks mortgage earnings as a group, we look at 10 bellwethers, Walters, Stonegate, Ocwen, NationStar. They didn't have the best quarter in earnings when you group them as one. There were some losses, I know, at Stonegate and NationStar. So they lagged the banks, but you know that's probably a one-time thing. It'll be interesting to see how they do in the second and third quarter. So that's interesting. The big news, though, I think today we didn't make it the lead, but LoanDepot. Whoa, we're hiring 1,000 people.
Yeah.
That's a biggie.
Yeah.
I know we've written about Freedom. Freedom has had huge hiring friends. Freedom, I should say, has had hiring plans, not fans, but maybe they have
plans
as well. Freedom in New Jersey, I mean, they're another fast grower. LoanDepot is one of the fastest growing among the top 20, according to numbers we crunch here at Inside Mortgage Finance. I mean, listen, production at a lot of these non-banks are doing fairly well. It's very interesting the way they continue to steal market share away from the banks. You know, we crunched our first quarter numbers recently. We came in at, $370 billion. And you know, MBA's estimate for the first quarter was probably about $90 billion under that. They may want to update their estimates on originations to reflect that. So, you know, things are looking, knock on wood, fairly well. Refis are still strong, though. Rates are going up, so that's probably going to slow. Hearing good things about the purchase market. The one laggard, though, is, you know, non-QM lending. You know, we hear lots of people talking about it, but, you know, not a lot of volumes out there. So we'll see.
Nope.
Servicing deals are hot. They continue to be hot. Bulk purchases. Prices have come down a little bit. Mountain View's out there with a couple deals. Phoenix Capital's out there with some deals. I know Interactive Mortgage Advisors, MIAC, and Prestwick are all working on deals. So the appetite's pretty good for servicing rights right now. We're crunching some numbers on VA lending. We found state-licensed mortgage originators. These are basically some of the non-banks are doing a nice volume in VA lending. I think in the past we've talked about how good the VA market is right now, and that's something we continue to watch. The Federal Housing Finance Agency, one of our stories is about diversity in the system. This has to do with the bank directors being what we call MWOBs, or more of them becoming MWOBs, which means minority or women-owned businesses or representatives of those kind of companies. In the short take section, the other big story is Black Knight is going public. They're part of Fidelity.
I saw that.
Yeah, yeah. They're also partly owned by Tommy Lee. I think Tommy Lee has a 35% stake. They used to be LPS. Then Fidelity bought them. Then they restructured them as Black Knight, and now you know, now they're spinning them off. Bill Foley, who runs Fidelity, has for years. I think he's about 7 years old now. He has a history of doing this. I know he doesn't like the value the stock market assigns into his companies. So he's he buys them back. He spins them off again. He's done this a number of times over the years, and it's always worked out to his advantage. And he looks like he's doing here with Black Knight, so we'll see what happens with that. That's pretty much all the highlights right now. We have one little note about how Fannie and Freddie keep reducing their loan loss reserves. Fannie and Freddie had earnings last week. Fannie earned more than Freddie. Freddie earned about a little more than $500 million. I think Fannie was more than twice that. Those two continue to earn money. Their G fees are in the range of north of 50 basis points, but they keep shrinking. So it's going to be interesting to see what they look like in 2 years. Presumably there'll be no legislative solution until we have a new person in the White House, whoever that might be. So that's sort of the status quo. So that's sort of the roundup. And that's it.
Well, a quick question I have a quick question for you on the servicing transfers. Any sense when you're talking to the, ones that you're interviewing on your story, Interactive Mortgage Advisors, MIAC, Preston Group, Prestwick Group, saying that wrong. Any sense on this is going to continue? What's their flavor when you're visiting with them about the servicing transfers?
What do you mean? Get deals continue? Well,
Are you getting deals approved? Yeah. Do you see deals approved and continuing to happen? There's been concern about what's going on in New York, but boy, you got to be at the secondary conference if you're not going to be there, because we've got.
John Bancroft,
the Attorney General,
staff will be there along with our new GSC editor, Carissa Chappell. So she'll be at that show. And the only thing we know, Ocwen is, they have four deals out there. I think at least one of them has been approved, maybe two. They don't exactly disclose when they're approved, but if you look at their servicing at the end of the quarter, they still have quite a bit of servicing on their books, which tells me their largest sales have not been approved yet. I don't get a sense that the Federal Housing Finance Agency wants to hold these up. I think they're happy to see these deals go away from Ocwen. If you're hearing, if you're hearing that there's trouble getting deals approved, let me know. I haven't heard any of that yet, but that doesn't mean it's not out there. So, are you hearing that deals are having trouble getting approved?
Well, I have. I mean, there has been some stories behind that. You're the guy that I listen to. People will call me on different parts of, where do they see that? Here's the reason I bring it up is I'm getting more calls that seems to be people more interested in moving portfolios, and I see a potential crescendo in this, especially if we see interest rates rising up. So is it a hold them or fold them, hold it or sell it? I mean, it'll be really interesting to see what's going on. But you do a real good job, Paul, in staying on top of that, and that's why I keep telling everybody they're not logged in, signed up to receive your daily email and checking out your website. They're just really missing out some great information. So appreciate you taking time to be here with us and give your update. What's going on? Well, greet everybody around there, and have yourself a great week, my friend.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye. Yeah, be sure. In fact, listen in. We got David Stevens
on
later.
What time is Dave Stevens calling in?
He's already called in. He's on hold listening to your report, so he'll be here. Okay. Yeah, so he'll be on. We'll probably be on with that pretty quickly here, probably within the next 5-10 minutes. So if you stay on,
great.
Love to have you listen to it. All right, man. Or you can tune in and listen to it on the Internet. All right, man.
All right.
Thank
bye-bye.
You, Paul. Appreciate you. All right, everybody, it's been good to I love Paul's stuff. First of all, it's his way of communicating, the way he goes after the stories. He is so well networked in there, and trust me, we know how he can stay on the story. When he wants to track something, he is really good at it. Check it out, www.imfnews.com. Normally, we'd be going out to Alice Alvey right now, but Alice, again, is traveling out to the West Coast. She's on an airplane and so cannot be joining us. That does happen. We have to go up and we have to travel and make money somewhere. So we're going to bring in Sam Garcia and get an update from Sam. It's good to have you here with us, Sam, back in Dallas. And, I like what Paul was doing, talking about some of the numbers. I know you cover some of it, but as it relates to hires. But let's take a look at what some of the news that you're tracking, friend.
Yes, you mentioned the Labor Department report last Friday and Joe's comments.
Yeah.
And basically, there was an unemployment rate of 5.4%. And what's significant about that, that's the lowest since May 2008, so prior to the darkest depths of the financial crisis. But more specifically, non-bank mortgage jobs were reported at 284,500, and that was up both from a month earlier and a year earlier. And then, as you know, we use that data combined with some market data we collect to come up with an estimate for the full industry, including banks and credit unions. And that stands at 570,600 people, including about 225,000 people at banks that work in the mortgage business, 60,000 people at credit unions, and around 285,000 non-bank mortgage jobs. That's the state of the industry for the moment, at least, based on our estimate.
Yeah.
And then we put out the mortgage market index for last week, which, of course, we put that out based on data from Optimal Bloom, and that was off about 1% from a week earlier. But inquiries for purchase financing were up 7%, so we hardly ever see that number having moved up recently, and it's nice to see that. ARM activity
It's encouraging.
6%. Yeah, yeah. Last week, there was a speech by FHFA Director Watt where he said that the HARP program would be extended until the end of 2016. Of course, we're not seeing a ton of activity on HARP, but the extension will certainly generate some more refinances. Ginnie Mae reported last week some data about its monthly issuance. It came out to $42.3 billion in April, which was the highest number that they've had since December 2009 when they did $42.4 billion. MGIC put out some monthly numbers, which is good because it gives you a little bit of insight, you know, an early insight about where delinquency is going. MGIC said they wrote $3.6 billion in new business in April, which is the same as the prior month. But their delinquent inventory fell below 69,700, which is the lowest since at least 2009 based on the oldest data we've got. Finally, the Mortgage Bankers Association put out their mortgage delinquency survey, and they reported that delinquency, 30-day delinquency excluding foreclosures, fell to 5.54% from 5.68% in the fourth quarter. And the foreclosure rate was down 4 basis points from the fourth quarter to 1.32. And that's everything, David.
Well, that's good stuff. I appreciate you being here. One of the reasons I am a fan of your website is the data that you have. You've got some really good studies and some good market data. It's a good complement to what the MBA publishes as well. That's why I'm a data hungry guy, especially when I'm doing this daily video that I do every day. And so I'm always looking for stuff, and I encourage people to check out your website. Go over there. You've got some wonderful information on it. And but the thing of all the things you do well, my friend, it's really the data analytics that's out there at a very affordable price, and I think that's very, very good. Again, it really is a good complement to some of the things the MBA is doing.
Very good. And the MBA is a great source for a lot of these great reports they put out, so they actually give us access to the full things, and there's some good stuff out there they put out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the studies they do are just second to none, but – and it's good that you report it, because I think you actually shine the light back towards them all the time when you, because you always quote the source. I think that's great. Appreciate it, Sam. If you want to learn more about what's going on, go check it out at www.mortgagedaily.com or email Sam at samgarcia@mortgagedaily.com or call him 214-521-1300. Always fun to have you with us, Sam. Have a great rest of the day.
Thank you, sir. Employ.
You bet. All right, looking forward to getting to our hot topic here pretty quickly. But before we do, you say, Dave, you're going a little fast today. You're talking. I've got so much questions. I can't wait to ask David Stevens to get into this discussion that it just worked out that we have Alice here. So we are going to have a lot to talk about, but we have Andy Schell, the Profit Doctor, on the line. So let's go to Andy real quickly, and then we'll go to an ad break and then bring David Stevens on. Andy, good to have you with us.
Well, you know, having Dave Stevens on is like having E.F. Hutton, you know, because when Dave speaks, people listen.
Yeah, people do.
Everybody stop.
They should.
Dave's going to say something. Wait, everybody, quiet down. Here it comes. So,
he's got that unique crow's nest, that unique position in the marketplace. He sees both sides you know, for those of us that are frustrated with a lot of the enforcement issues going on, I mean, he has a unique perspective, and I think we need to draw on that as we draw these conclusions. Before we draw conclusions, we really need it, so it's really good. But, Andy, you've been talking a lot about some real important topics. Why don't you give us your focus?
Run the ad first. Chuck Klein, MBA National Secondary Marketing Conference. Coming up,
right.
Going to be speaking, M&A, got to attend the session. There are some, he's going to be speaking with Richie May, and there are some deep, deep, deep purchase accounting issues relating to the acquisition of a mortgage company called purchase accounting that have some very serious unintended consequences from the creation of goodwill. Chuck's going to get into all of that. You got to go to a session, go to New York, go to the conference, listen to Chuck. There you go.
Yep.
I had to say
He's speaking at the secondary conference. Thank you so much. Yeah, put in a good word for our partner. He's speaking there. That's good. Thanks to the MBA for inviting him to come and speak. It is really an important topic, and the complexities that go with that, and as well as accounting, are really important. So anything, what else you got there, Profit Doctor? I know you got so many things that you're focused on.
Well, I just have one key point, and that is we all know how important having good technology underneath our companies is. We've got to have a solid technology infrastructure. You want to walk into your house, turn on the light switch, lights come on, go out, start your car, starts instantly. We want our technology to work perfectly every time. But you have to install technology. You have to manage technology. You have to upgrade technology. There's all these TRID updates coming through. And when a salesperson comes into your office and starts talking about how amazing it's going to be to go from the system you're on, which everybody complains about, to the system you want to go, you've just got to sign up because it sounds so great. Until you talk to the customers who actually use the new system who say, it sucks, it's bad, we don't like it. Everybody hates their system. And so it's a matter of being mindful of the issues. So have a good, solid implementation plan. The point I'm making is that we've surveyed probably 20 companies who recently went through a technology transition, and 19 of them had a bad experience. And the reason they had a bad experience is because they did not properly plan the implementation. It took longer. They didn't understand the resource allocation that was required. I'm to the point, Dave, where I'm saying to people, if you're looking at changing systems and you're talking to your vendor and they're telling how long it's going to take, whatever it is, double the time, double the cost. But really, a more accurate way of dealing with that is if you're looking at changing systems, get a hold of your CPA, get a hold of us, get somebody else to give you an independent verification of your implementation plan. We see this happen so often where technology is not deployed correctly, but it can be. It can be. It can be done well. It's not a crapshoot. It's not random. There's reasons why things fail, and there's reasons how to make it so that they don't fail. So give us a call. Call your CPA. Get somebody to look at your implementation plan to make certain you're going to get what you think you're going to get so that we can stop having all these bad deployments. So there you go. That's my soapbox. I'm done.
Good soapbox. I always appreciate and interested in what you're stumping on, the latest issue you're stumping on. I appreciate it. Folks, we're going to be right back after this brief break with David Stevens, President, CEO. I said chairman earlier. I meant President, CEO of the MBA. Correction on that previous title correction, and we'll be right back after this brief break.
Mortgage Banking Solutions is the preeminent management consulting firm to the residential mortgage lending industry. No other firm in the U.S. offers the menu of services or the level of expertise to the industry.
If you're looking for help converting from best efforts to hedging, or need help with bookkeeping to know your profit per loan,
if you are interested in making the transition from broker to banker, or if you just need a roadmap for success,
Mortgage Banking Solutions' primary focus is to enable executives to take their business to the next level and guide them down a path towards success and profitability. With over 300 combined years of experience in all facets of mortgage lending, the Mortgage Banking Solutions team of professionals has the expertise and know-how to help you accomplish your goals. New warehouse lines of credit,
broker to banker transitions, transitioning to hedging,
financial and accounting services,
or meeting your capitalization needs.
If you need help with these or any other aspects of your business, please contact a Mortgage Banking Solutions sales team to see how we can help you at 512-977-9900. That's 512-977-9900. Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level.
Appreciate you tuning in with us, everybody, and telling others about it. We have grown our broadcast as a result of word of mouth and you being so good at telling others. So appreciate that. Man, there's a lot of people dialed in today. And we have, and a lot of reasons, because of our special guest, we have with us today David Stevens, who's president and CEO. I said earlier, president, chairman, is president and CEO of the Mortgage Bankers Association, of the which also we commonly refer to as the MBA. And he is going to be our guest on today's topic. We're going to be talking about what are the questions, what are the issues that are boiling in his mind, that are top of mind for him. And I love what David said. He said, he came back and says, let's get the rules right. And that was encouraging for me to hear, and that they are focusing on it, because it's one of the things that is frustrating so many out there, is getting the rules right. So, David Stevens, good to have you with us. Appreciate, I know what kind of a busy guy you are. And for you to take time out and bless us with your presence and share your wisdom and perspective is very valued, David.
Great to be with you, David, always.
Always good to have you. One of the things when we were talking as we were getting ready for the broadcast was stopping. You wrote back, said, Dave, I got so many issues and want to get to hopefully to all of them that you wrote about. But the one that really leaped out at me of the issues is stopping excessive enforcement. And I want to start there. I would first of all like to get your perspective on this. I have been unpopular. We have all been unpopular at times for anyone who said we brought this on ourselves to a degree. And that isn't a popular statement, but it is reality. But it seems like the pendulum has swung too far, David. and we've gone over into the realm of excessive force enforcement. You're closer to this than anybody inside the Beltway, and being the leader of our trade association and for our whole industry, quite frankly, what is your perspective on this?
Well, look, it's obviously a complicated subject, but I think the thing that really stands out for all of us is it was the point a couple of weeks ago when Quicken Loans actually filed a preemptive lawsuit against the Department of Justice. They subsequently filed their own lawsuit against Quicken Loans. But, you know, this is another step, and enforcement comes from all areas of Washington, D.C., and all the state regulators and state's attorneys general, so it can come from any variety of locations. But this particular one is where the Inspector General of HUD, in using the False Claims Act, will go after a lender for defects in loan files, claiming that they falsely made a claim for the insurance payment on the FHA program. If you lose those cases, you're subject to treble damage claims per incident, per loan file. I mean, the punishment clearly does not match the crime, especially when the vast majority of loan file defects are not material or correctable. And unfortunately, these cases go beyond that. But the Quicken suit, just to make the point, you couldn't ask for a better plaintiff, I don't think, to argue a case like this. Their compare ratio is, you know, 45. They've won the J.D. Powers Award for customer service, I think, five years in a row. They've moved their headquarters into downtown Detroit, reinvesting in one of the hardest hit communities we've ever seen in this country from this last recession. And you know, when they're fighting back, I think it emboldens sort of the whole industry. I was going to give Bill Emerson a Superman cape when he came on the stage at secondary, but I don't think I'll go that far. But you know, it really articulates the anger.
Yeah, and it does. I think it's he's another one of those guys. I admire him at many levels. Had a chance to spend some time with him at the president's event that you had a couple of years ago. And I spoke there, and I've always admired him, his leadership that he brings. And, you know, you look at someone who's a leader, they step up and sometimes take those unpopular issues and they step out ahead of the industry. And because of who they, their reputation, I mean, that they didn't buy that J.D. Powers Award. That is truly a very independent study, and they are best at origination and servicing consistently. So, kudos to Bill. I would be one to support that. When you look at this kind of excessive enforcement, let's talk a little bit about the momentum. Are you seeing, David, from your perspective, things shifting where would there – it's. Let me rephrase that. It seemed like the administration even saw that maybe we've gone too far with this. And at one point in time, there seemed like they say, we got to be careful that we don't damage the industry that's going to really be the engine of growth for economic growth. And there seemed to be at one point some easing off, and then we just see another wave of lawsuits after that. Where do you see the momentum? Is it shifting at all away from excessive, or are we?
I think we have a ways to go, David. So look, we've been in this thing now since, you know, really 2009, when the Dodd-Frank legislation was in peak battle up on Capitol Hill, and then we spent the next few years implementing these rules and trying to figure out how to do it right and adding compliance staff, et cetera, et cetera. It just seems like no matter how hard you try, you still can't get it right, and you're still subject to some form of risk. I'd highlight the American Banker article today, which talks about CFPB's use of fair lending violations and quoting back you know, old history about redlining cases that they think are existing and creating discrimination today. The problem is this. You know, I always hear people like, why can't the president fix this? It's his fault. Or so-and-so needs to stop this. It's the HUD secretary. These are things that are, at this point, not in the White House control. When they come from the Department of Justice, who's an independent regulator and an inspector general, they're not Secretary Castro's issue, because the IG is an independent overseer of risk at HUD. But it is, without question, the collective weight. It's the HUD does play a role, and the secretary plays a role. Just take this one False Claims Act approach that's being used. We never dealt with False Claims Act cases pre-2011. In fact, I was FHA commissioner when we first identified
right.
that this was an out, this was a law that could be used, and many of us inside did not want it used because we thought it would open a Pandora's box and be used in an inappropriate way. But it's been used by the Inspector General, and one thing that HUD, I think, could help with is they could better clarify what defects are you really going to be held accountable and which ones are you not going to be held accountable, which ones are egregious and material that are clearly, you know, what we call fat thumb mistakes, where the same employee does it over and
right.
over and over again. Those are things that a lender can be held accountable for. But minor mistakes in a file that wouldn't have made a difference whether the loan would have been done in the first place, or minor mistakes that can be corrected, those don't deserve the same kind of response. And yet it appears that the way the IG and the DOJ are behaving, it's one size fits all. Any mistake is equal to the next. And it, the outcome of this is going to be clear. You know, wealthy, well-heeled home buyers with large down payments, great credit scores, you know, with all the money in the world, they're going to get all the mortgages they want one way or the other. But these
yep.
actions are going to ultimately stop lending to the people that, quite frankly, most of these policymakers
yep.
care about. And,
yeah.
you know, it's very difficult to accuse someone of disparate impact when they're trying to follow the rules, especially when they know if they go too far, they're going to be hit with a False Claims Act for every mistake and every file that goes to default. It just doesn't add up. The rules do not make sense when complying with one rule creates conflict in another and ultimately could put your company out of business.
It's so true. Looking at some questions that are coming in from listeners that are texting me already. If you guys want to text me, my cell phone number is 512-632-2900. It's probably the best way for me to notice your questions in mid-broadcast here. So, David, one of the questions that came in is, you know, they look at the Quicken deal. How much is this politically motivated? That's one of those things. I hate to even go there, but it's one question that's come in several times since we started this broadcast. Is there any credence to aspects of this being politically motivated? They're going after certain ones before for one reason or another?
No, I don't think there's political motivation. I would tell you that there's two large cases going on the, using the False Claims Act. And by the way, for your listeners, enforcement actions come from all sorts of different agencies for different reasons, and so you almost need to parse them. An enforcement action from the CFPB is very different than an IG using false claims with the Department of Justice. Just entirely different sources for where those claims come. But anyway, there's two big cases related to the False Claims Act, both against very large institutions. Quicken is one of them. Quicken,
yep.
quite frankly, politically is the fair-haired child in Washington. They're viewed as, you know, they're getting accolades for what they've done to reinvest in Detroit and some of the what
yeah.
we call the brown state markets. So, if there was a political motivation here to go after Quicken, that would not make sense. I think where the focus is coming from inspectors generals is that the larger targets create the biggest opportunity for a big settlement, a big statement to be made in the markets and showing their ability to enforce protections for the taxpayers as they might look at it. So I don't call that political. I just think that, you know, attorneys like big cases. They set precedents, and they're using this particular process to try to get really
yeah.
big settlements out of institutions. The one thing I would just say is, in most cases, banks settle. There's been a bunch of settlements using this approach.
Yes.
There's only two that are actively being fought in the courts and defended by the institutions. And I think until we see one of these cases go through the courts and hopefully see an institution prevail or broadly prevail to a much smaller kind of settlement action, you know, we got to keep sort of ducking and hoping that none of us get picked out
yeah.
as a lender in the marketplace, because as we all know, and everybody on this call knows who does mortgages, and you're looking at your monthly error rates that are coming out of your QC process, you know, every loan, for the most part, has some form of mistake in it. And so it's pretty difficult to try to encourage you to expand credit when you know that by doing so, that loan has a slightly higher likelihood of going into default, and that default creates a higher likelihood
yeah.
of some action coming against you.
It is. It's really interesting. I really applaud Bill Emerson for stepping up and taking the leadership role that he has on this one, because, like you said, I think there's no better poster child of doing it right or trying to do it right. Not that any of us can do it right because of the vagueness in that. Andy's got a quick question for you. Andy Schell?
Well, hey, Dave, I actually have a two-part question, if you don't mind. The first point you were talking about is stopping excessive enforcement, and you gave a great example with a HUD IG and the impacts and the irrelevant to mortgage loss. But what about the CFPB? What about the CFPB?
Yep.
Do you see issues with excessive enforcement coming from the CFPB? And then I have a follow-up.
Yeah, so the CFPB cases have been less public, but, you know, we all are aware of the fact that when they go do an on-site audit, there is a question as to whether they pivot too quickly from doing the on-site review to what's called a CID, where they actually find some errors in their process that could violate the CFPB rules and then immediately refer to the enforcement division. Most prudential regulators of financial institutions, everybody here who's a lender knows, deals with some regulator, either at state or federal level, most prudential regulators, they'll work through common day-to-day issues with the lender. Lenders may implement operational changes in order to satisfy the regulator, and there's a lot of back and forth. It doesn't automatically go to enforcement unless it's truly egregious. What is a bit concerning out of the Bureau is the use of unfair deceptive practices, what's called UDAP. And so applying rules that came into place post Dodd-Frank against book loans that were made previous to the rule. So they use UDAP as an effort to broaden the pool in that process. We're raising that question with the Bureau itself. But again, as I would tell Rich Cordray, and I do tell him this, and I speak to him frequently, is that, you know, this is a time to create confidence in the markets, not to continue trying to find institutions and find reasons to pursue actions against institutions that aren't engaging in malicious acts with intent. So we need to separate foot faults and lenders trying to operationalize a very complex set of rules that have come into place with those that are purposefully trying to commit fraud. And until we do that, we're going to keep this level of fear. I call it defensive lending. That's how we're lending in America today. Yep. It's a defensive lending environment. Until we can remove that defensive lending environment, you know, it's our perspective, credit will remain tight. And I think ultimately that's the argument we need to make with everybody. It's the response to all of this is that fewer consumers get access to home ownership. And the consumers that aren't getting access are the ones that they're actually making these rules to try to protect in most cases. So this isn't a matter of saying stop Dodd-Frank or the CFPB is wrong. I mean, the Bureau actually is doing a lot of good things too. It's identifying those things that are we think excessive and are need to be stopped. It's why I was so vocal on something so simple as that rate checker tool. I just couldn't let it sit that they would put out a tool that in an effort to somehow help consumers that actually underdisclosed rates and terms far more so than lenders are obligated to require. I thought and still think it's a terrible example of what the Bureau shouldn't do. And we, you know, they should try to themselves to recognize when they make their own mistakes and try to use their seat in an effort to protect consumers to create consistency, common standards applied to all lenders, and not force knee-jerk responses by lending institutions across the country simply out of fear.
Person just wrote me real quickly. Yeah, great. It said, what is CID? They said they filed a CID. They're not familiar with that.
Well, if you go through a CFPB audit and you're issued a CID, it's a demand that you meet with their enforcement bureau. I think it's within 10 days following the identification of the mistake that they found. I don't want to go into that process, but we do question the sort of judicial process that these institutions have to go through and the risk to the individual that ultimately has to go sort of defend the mistakes that were identified by the Bureau without the ability to have an attorney present and a lot of other issues. So the point here is this immediate transition to enforcement, not in all cases, but that we have seen in many cases, we think it could take a different path where, as a prudential regulator, they could be working to provide leadership and advise the lending community that's trying to do this right.
Mm-hmm.
Again, separating out the egregious violators, which is a very, very small minority of American lending today, but really help the lending community get the rules right the way we want to. Because anybody in this call knows, if you're listening to this call, it's because you are trying to get it right. And that's just ultimately the pathway we need to be working towards.
Andy, you had another question.
Follow up, if I could, if you don't mind, Dave and Dave.
Sure. Go ahead.
And that is as we've sort of thrown up this a backstop of irrelevant to mortgage loss. So the IG pursuing things based on False Claims Act, irrespective of if it would really cause a loss to the fund or to the originator or whatever. And yet we also have, on the other side, the CFPB coming up with a whole bunch of rules, a whole bunch of stuff, servicing and compliance management and third-party management, the TRID and all this stuff. And so having spent most of my career in regulated depository mortgage lending, I'm used to having lots of rules. And we talk to people who go, when we say, have you implemented third-party management? Well, no, because we don't think the CFPB really cares because it's not relevant to origination. So it doesn't matter if our vendors have the appropriate service level agreement because nobody cares. How do we balance as originators the focus of big picture? It's irrelevant to mortgage loss directly, although one could argue that it could be. But how do you get everybody on board with CFPB rules are here to stay. We're going to have to follow them. We might not like them all. Some of them might not directly have impact on direct mortgage loss, like third-party management, compliance management systems as a whole. How do you help people get on board with we got to do it all?
Well, let's see. I can't give you the answer that would do service to the minutes left on the call, other than to say that to a large degree, I think commonality and response is going to be the benefit of everybody. So, whether you get it out of one of our conferences or wherever you get sort of a mutual understanding, I'm going to be speaking at the Richie May conference out in Colorado just to talk to their clients. I think the one-off institution that isn't prepared is the one that's most exposed. I also think there's a little bit of cover for an institution that's just very small because ultimately the Bureau and generally any enforcement division can only work so fast through so many institutions. But whether it's third party or TRID compliance, just take loan officer compensation programs or marketing service agreements and whether they're RESPA compliant. I mean, we have a list, I think it's 22 pages of questions that we've completed in very small font and submitted to the Bureau asking them for written declarative FAQs, specific answers to questions. Just related to TRID on its own. And
just related to TRID. Wow.
And one of our concerns about the FAQs is that regulators don't like to write written responses. They like to give verbal feedback. And in this case, we're really pushing hard for written responses. This is an iterative process, but I think in the end of the day, the best way to manage if you're an institution out there is you need to be part of a group, a networking group. If you're a member of the MBA, you should reach out to me right away. We have groups that have weekly calls and just do nothing but go through this, and it's an open invitation to anybody who wants to join. But it is a challenge. And, will everybody be ready on August 1st when TRID is implemented? My assumption is no. But I do believe that if every institution has done what they've been at their very best been trying to implement and be ready for TRID with all due diligence and is generally following the suggested practices of their vendors who, if they're well-known vendors, I think generally speaking, they're going to be not at risk for short-term enforcement kind of actions. And I think the Bureau will most likely make that clear in some fashion. But this is confusing time, and we are war torn. We've reached operational implementation maximization. We just can't take any more right now. And we need to, you know, one thing so we're emphasizing the Bureau is when TRID rolls out, let's take a breather here, guys. Let's give us a chance now. For the last 2 years, we've been nonstop change management. We need to now get a chance to get the entire set of players that are involved in our industry to catch up.
Yeah, it's so true. Let's. I'm looking at the clock and all the little time we have left. It's just so much here to go. I want to talk about needed changes to Dodd-Frank rules. What are the needed changes from your perspective, and what are you guys working on, and how can we get involved?
So let me just high level. First of all, you know, what I bristle at is hearing folks that I worked with when I was in the administration. Elizabeth Warren, for example, was an advisor to Tim Geithner, and I was on the housing team working with the secretary and a group of others and met with her frequently. We all knew that Dodd-Frank wasn't perfect. The idea that certain members of Congress would say that any changes to Dodd-Frank or the rules is a terrible thing and you're trying to destroy Dodd-Frank is ridiculous. These laws are made ugly because they go through a congressional process. They're never perfect, and you need to make changes after you see it in effect. So example number one, the qualified mortgage rule. It doesn't work. If we were actually underwriting to the rule, 43 DTI and an appendix Q, credit would be significantly tighter. What's protecting us is what we call the patch, this temporary, and it is this relatively temporary because it's only as long as the GSEs are in conservatorship or 7 years. This patch that says if it's Freddie Fannie acceptable, then you're okay. If everybody had to really underwrite to the rule, we'd be in a far worse position. So the rule needs to be modified. We need to find a way to allow judgment to be used, particularly for self-employed borrowers, borrowers with variable income, people buying a home who may have multiple income sources coming into that home. I can name a variety of examples. That's one. Two, the points and fees rule. You know, what makes me sort of crazy about the points and fees rule is we're in a system where the president has said, and Rich Cordray said, the goal is to make this simpler so that the consumer can understand when they're getting a mortgage, they can compare. I think it's pretty difficult to actually compare when one loan officer has to quote his income differently than another because he's in a non-bank environment, or the title title has to be disclosed differently because it's affiliated or not affiliated. I mean, that's what perplexes me about the whole SAFE Act, which was a predecessor to all of this, is we created different rules that give, in essence, disparate treatment depending on what kind of business model you have in this marketplace. If we're trying to create consistency and commonality for consumers, we need to eliminate all of these different rules that get applied differently for different institutions. And so, you know, points and fees is one. The qualified mortgage rule is a big one that I think needs to actually be written in a far more nuanced way to give far greater credence to the logic of real underwriting, the way we learned it once upon a time. But there are a variety of other changes we need to make to the National Servicing Standards rule, to the LO Comp rule, et cetera, that are ultimately going to have to be implemented.
I want to get over to the SAFE Act fixes that are necessary, specifically transitional licensing.
Yeah. Well, look, there's a lot of folks out there who believe that I take a test, everybody should have to take a test. Now, I'll tell you, personally speaking, I completely agree with that. This is an issue that's been worked on long before I came into Washington. I was running the single-family business at Freddie Mac for almost a decade. We had a project working on this back in the 90s to have a common testing standard. I mean, quite frankly, you can become a loan officer for a bank almost easier than you can become a hairdresser in Washington, D.C., because if you're a hairdresser, you got to pass a test and go to a school. It is, and I don't mean that in the wrong way, but I do worry about adverse selection. I also worry about consumer confidence. I would love it if we could go out on the podium and say, okay, America, doesn't matter who you take a loan from today, no matter who they work for or where they are, they've all met the same standardized testing, education and testing requirements. We can't say that today. We can say it for part of the industry, but not all of it. This isn't, to me, it's not about like picking winners or losers or fairness. It is to many of you. To me, it's about making sure we have a system that's consistent for everybody. And that creates the greatest
right.
competitive opportunity and gives the consumer the same experience. SAFE Act. So we're not going to get testing requirements through Congress. Just not going to happen. I could explain that later. But what we can get done is this idea of transitional licensing. It's step one. The transitional licensing law, if
yes.
passed, would say that if you're changing companies and you're going, let's say, from a bank to a non-bank, that you have 90 days to pass the test. As long as you were a practicing employee in the field and, no legal exposure as a result of your work, et cetera, you're just merely changing jobs, you should be able to keep doing your work while you take your new job. And if your new job now requires you to take a test, allow for a transitional period for you to, go through education and testing requirements and ultimately become approved. And if you don't pass, then ultimately you can't stay in that job. But, the thing we have right now is we have impediments to a person's ability to move between jobs within their career simply because of this barrier to entry, which doesn't make sense.
What's the MBA recommending as far as the transitional licensing period? Is it 90 days? What are you looking at?
Well, there's a piece of legislation now that has co-sponsorship in the House that would have a 90-day transition. We had a variety of original recommendations, but keep in mind, gang, that we go up and we'll actually go up sometimes with draft legislative text, and we'll suggest to various members. And I will tell you, I personally met with Republicans and Democrats in the House and the Senate on this issue. We finally found some interested members on the House side that actually wanted to sponsor a bill, and that a bipartisan sponsorship. So it's a great step. Now, they ultimately draft their own language. It's their staff that drafts the text. They've got to negotiate amongst each other. That, as it stands now, has a 90-day provision in it. And that's something that is certainly reasonable and that most people can comply with in most states right now.
That's okay. That seems reasonable. I'm looking at the minutes. I want to cover these issues because so many people tuned in to listen to us get at least through the main four and the marketing agreements, MSAs, marketing agreements that are out there. What do you see happening there? Is this becoming more of an issue or less of an issue?
Look, I think the scrutiny on marketing service agreements will only increase over time. And I think at the core, I think the real legal question that ultimately has to be answered probably by the Bureau is a marketing service agreement unto itself an item of value? Is the fact you actually have an agreement, does that become an item of value? I know that there are some out there that can be well run. I think it's I'm a practitioner, as you know, David. I come from the business. I worked for a large company that had joint ventures, and I actually testified in a class action suit as a witness, related to a kickback accusation. This is a highly volatile issue. I would just caution anybody who's engaging in MSAs to make sure they have a really well-known national RESPA lawyer and not just take some attorney who wants to be hired by them who will give them the answer they want, because that ultimately won't necessarily prevail if you have to go to court. I just think it's an issue that's not going to go away, and the focus on this is only going to increase, I think, over time.
Especially as we see interest rates rising, everyone's trying to figure out a way, how can we lock up more business? There's more momentum, it seems, within independent mortgage bankers to go towards a marketing arrangement. They see other companies doing it, but I don't know that they've seen the effort that has gone in by those companies to get it right and get, more importantly, the legal counsel before they launch it. I think you want to underscore that point you make. David, you were an originator. Your roots are in origination. What do you think's going on? I mean, we're seeing a shift in the purchase market. Words of wisdom for those that are struggling with that shift as we wrap up the broadcast.
Hey, we're going back in time. This is old school, man. I mean, I started in the very early 1980s when interest rates were in the high teens, and there was no refinance market whatsoever. We made our money the old-fashioned way. We went out, called on realtors every day, and worked to get the purchase business. That's the market we're heading into here. And this rate shifting is going to be a long-term scenario, not a short-term one from our perspective. And so, you know, those that are, have access to the point of sale, real legitimate access to the point of sale and have focused on, they're going to be, at least in the short run, they're going to be the beneficiaries of having built up that reputation. Those that aren't, you know, it's still a, it's a wonderful industry, and the demographics are going to call for extraordinary demand for housing over the next decade. I think from that end, there is opportunity. It just means that for many, they've got to shift their business mentality if they were refi focused into purchase.
Yep. It is so important. David, thank you so much. I applaud what you are doing there at the MBA with so many initiatives. One of my favorite ones is the recruiting and equipping of the next generation mortgage bankers, mortgage banking bound. We had Jeff Schumer on along with Brendan Berry. It was just they did an outstanding job. I can't, folks, go back and listen to that. April 27th broadcast. Again, great group around there. I'm impressed with the team that you've brought to the MBA and the leadership you're providing to them and, quite frankly, to our industry. Thank you, David, so much for being here with us today, and I look forward to having you back here soon.
Thanks, David.
You bet. Well, folks, we're out of time. It's good to have you be with us. Be sure to download this. I will be rebroadcasting this segment that we did today. We'll be rebroadcasting it tomorrow. We'll be backing out all of the first part of the segment. It'll be just David, and I'll always edit it back a little bit, clean it up a little bit. And so if you want to listen to just this topic, check out the link that will be provided tomorrow. It's so good to have you with us. Have a great week, everybody. Tune in next week. We'll be back with another hot topic. Thank you.
This has been Lickin' on Lending, a weekly mortgage market update with your host, David Lickin of Mortgage Banking Solutions, enabling executives to take their business to the next level. Today's guests were Joe Farr from MBS Quoteline, Andy Schell of Mortgage Banking Solutions, and Alice Alvey, President CMB of Mortgage U. Come by next week, and thank you for listening.